I was born and raised in Chicago, Illinois, a fairly large city in the United States. And you can't tell this by listening to me, but I'm 6'8" tall. And I come from a family of athletes. Both my brothers played college basketball. My one brother was drafted in the National Basketball Association, professional basketball here in the United States. I went to college on a basketball scholarship. And then after I graduated, I moved home to find my job. Now I'm really dating myself. This was long before the internet was available. And I was kind of all set to, you know, make my mark on the world with my newly obtained business administration degree. Fortunately, I was able to find that first job. I actually was employed in the corporate headquarters of Wendy's International, the fast food, the hamburger chain. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, I ended up living with my parents for the next 3.5 years as I helped my mom care for my grandmother and my father, who were both dying of different forms of cancer. In my professional career, I've had quite a few jobs. As I said, I was in the marketing department at Wendy's. I was also a hospital administrator. I was a customer service manager, a police officer. And while I was a police officer, I was an undercover narcotics investigator, and I was a SWAT team hostage negotiator. After that, I was a school security consultant. I was a girls' high school basketball coach. And then most recently, I've been a speaker, and you mentioned my book, Sustainable Excellence. But for the last 9 years, I've been battling a rare form of cancer. And then finally, my wife and I have been married for 27 years, and our only child, a daughter, is a graduate of the United States Air Force Academy and is an officer in the newly created Space Force. We created a new branch of the military about a year ago, and she's kind of on the ground floor with that. So that's kind of in a nutshell, me.
So let's begin this week's episode. Hello, everyone, and welcome to this week's episode. I am delighted to welcome onto my show an inspiring gentleman who brings with him a unique and positive bend to the idea of mental health and self-improvement. He is also an author of his recently released book, which is titled Sustainable Excellence, 10 Principles to Lead in Your Uncommon and Extraordinary Life. Amongst many other struggles he has faced in his life, which we will go through them in this episode, let's welcome Terry Tucker to the show.
Thank you very much. I'm excited to talk with you tonight.
Oh, Terry, thank you so much. And when we started the communication between both of us, you sort of, in one of your emails, you sort of break down, you know, these are the topics that I can talk about, you know, whichever ones would be good, da da da. But to be fair to you and to the listeners, I feel that we need to really start, we need to go back and start somewhere in your life where actually you feel sort of really comfortable talking about whichever parts of this episode that you want to discuss. But I feel that if we sort of go back and start from, I say the beginning, but wherever that feels the beginning for you. So I'm going to hand it over to you. And we're just going to go with the flow for the listeners.
Sure. So I'll give you the kind of Reader's Digest version, and then you can pick whatever rabbit hole you want to go down, and we'll do that. So I was born and raised in Chicago, Illinois, a fairly large city in the United States. And you can't tell this by listening to me, but I'm 6'8" tall. And I come from a family of athletes. Both my brothers played college basketball. My one brother was drafted in the National Basketball Association, professional basketball here in the United States. I went to college on a basketball scholarship. And then after I graduated, I moved home to find my job. Now I'm really dating myself. This was long before the internet was available. And I was kind of all set to, you know, make my mark on the world with my newly obtained business administration degree. Fortunately, I was able to find that first job. I actually was employed in the corporate headquarters of Wendy's International, the fast food, the hamburger chain. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, I ended up living with my parents for the next 3.5 years as I helped my mom care for my grandmother and my father, who were both dying of different forms of cancer. In my professional career, I've had quite a few jobs. As I said, I was in the marketing department at Wendy's. I was also a hospital administrator. I was a customer service manager, a police officer. And while I was a police officer, I was an undercover narcotics investigator, and I was a SWAT team hostage negotiator. After that, I was a school security consultant. I was a girls' high school basketball coach. And then most recently, I've been a speaker, and you mentioned my book, Sustainable Excellence. But for the last 9 years, I've been battling a rare form of cancer. And then finally, my wife and I have been married for 27 years, and our only child, a daughter, is a graduate of the United States Air Force Academy and is an officer in the newly created Space Force. We created a new branch of the military about a year ago, and she's kind of on the ground floor with that. So that's kind of in a nutshell, me.
I don't know which part to delve into. The one bit, though, to be honest with you, Terry, the one bit that really does, I mean, all of it is just amazing, your life, you know, what the very different styles of your life, the, you know, the way that you approached different types of styles of work as well, which is really interesting, because it's all, there's a variety of all sorts there, you know. For me, though, it's something that I've been really wanting to talk to you about anyway, when you reached out to me. And I just want to, if you don't mind, if, because this is a really personal topic for you, but if you could just talk a bit about your cancer, if you don't mind.
No, I don't mind at all. I was, as I said, a girls' high school basketball coach. And in 2012, I had a callus that broke open on the bottom of my foot, right below my third toe. And being a coach, you're on your feet a lot. So I didn't give it a lot of credit. But after a couple of weeks when it didn't heal, I went to see a podiatrist, a foot doctor friend of mine. And he did some, you know, simple things like put pads in my shoes and stuff, which didn't work. And then he took an x-ray and he said, yeah, you might have a little cyst in here and I can cut it out. And he did. And it was, he showed it to me. It was just a little gelatin sack with some white fat in it. No blood, nothing dark, nothing that would lead anybody to think that anything was out of the ordinary. But he sent it off to pathology to have it looked at. 2 weeks later, he calls me. And as I said, he was a friend. So the more difficulty he was having explaining what was going on, the more frightened I was becoming, until he just laid it out. He said, Terry, I've been a doctor for 25 years and I have never seen this form of cancer. And I suggest you go to this MD Anderson, probably one of the better cancer hospitals in the United States, maybe in the world. And so I did. I went to MD Anderson. I had the tumor cut out of the bottom of my foot, and I had all the lymph nodes in my groin removed. And after I finished that and healed, I was put on a drug called interferon. And I took a weekly interferon injection for almost 5 years. And imagine, I guess, what interferon did for me was it gave me flu-like symptoms for 2 to 3 days every week. So imagine having the flu every week for 5 years. And that's kind of what I went through just to keep the disease from coming back. This wasn't a cure. This was, we're going to try to hold it off. Once the interferon was completed, that was 2017, the disease came back. 2018, my left foot was amputated because of the cancer. 2019, it came back again in my shin, had two more surgeries. And then last year, an undiagnosed tumor in my ankle grew large enough that it fractured my tibia, my shin bone, and further testing found out that my entire lower leg was full of cancer. So last April, right in the middle of this wonderful global pandemic, I had my left leg amputated, and also found out I have tumors in my lungs and I'm undergoing treatment for those right now. So that kind of in a nutshell is what I've been through since 2012.
Wow. I feel actually quite emotional listening to you, to be honest with you, because your persona and your, well, we're going to talk about this. We're going to lead on to this in a minute, how you are such a ball of light, even with the darkest of stuff that you've gone, you're still going through now. And you have this mindset of positivity and, you know, you are literally going to break down the walls with your mental health side of things, because you are not going to let anything beat you, your mind. And this is where it's a great subject to talk about for the listeners, to just to reach out even just to that one person that is going through their struggles in their life, and to listen to your story as well. And now we're going to lead on now to the next chapter and the next phase, should I say, which is that what are your four, because you've got these four, what's the word you use? Sorry.
Truths.
The four truths. And for me, where you focus on healthy aspects of when you were being sick, right? So can it, obviously this is, no, is this, am I correct in saying the four truths is sort of, well, it has originated, has it, from your cancer journey? And did you have like an enlightenment moment at any stage of your illness, maybe, that it came to where you thought, hold on a minute, I need to really like fight through this. How did you come to the four truths? So just explain it to us.
Sure. So I kind of feel like I've gotten through these last 9 years. It started off with what I call the three F's: faith, family, and friends.
Yeah.
And then kind of over my athletic career, even starting back in high school, and then when I was in law enforcement and things like that, things kind of developed and eventually crystallized. So I'll give you the four truths and sort of explain a little bit about them. And then we can kind of delve into them further, or any of them if you'd like. So the first one is, you need to control your mind or it will control you. So when I was in high school, I was a really good basketball player. And I don't mean to be conceited by that, but I was recruited to play basketball in college. And I went to college for free to play basketball. And when I was in high school, I had three knee surgeries, and my mind started to put these like negative thoughts in my head. It's like, you know, you're a step slower, or coaches aren't going to be interested in recruiting you, and things like that. And that's the first time I quickly realized that, no, I need to change that narrative. If I listen to those little voices in there,
yeah,
I'm going to be nothing. I am going to be a step slower. Nobody's going to want to recruit me. So you've got to change the narrative. Whatever that negative thought in your mind is, flip it to something positive.
Yeah.
Like, no, you know what? I'm still playing at an elite level. I'm still having coaches call me and interested in recruiting me. Mm-hmm. So that's the first one. The second one is, you need to embrace the pain and the suffering that we all experience in life and use it to make you a stronger and more determined individual. Mm-hmm. We know that our brains are hardwired to avoid pain and discomfort, excuse me, and to seek pleasure. So when pain comes our way, we try to get away from it. I've learned, and I wish I knew how, because I'd write a book and then go live on a beach in Jamaica somewhere. But I've learned to kind of take that pain and flip it inside and use it as energy, or burn it as fuel to make me stronger, to make me tougher, to make me more determined. And believe me, I am the biggest wimp in the world. I mean, when I was a little kid, my mother would take me to the pediatrician for a vaccine. I'd wait till she got out of the car and I'd lock all the doors from the inside. And this was before key fobs were available. And she'd have to go get the pediatrician and his nurse. And it was a cat and mouse game just to get me out of the car, just to get a simple injection. So I don't want anybody out there to think that, you know, I have a big S on my chest and I wear a cape. I don't. I have bad days just like everybody else. I cry, I get down. We're all going to experience pain in life. Pain is inevitable. Suffering, on the other hand, that's optional. That's optional because it's what you do with that suffering. Do you wallow in it or do you keep moving forward? So that's number two. Number three, and number three is one that I've added fairly recently, just because I think it's important. I think we need to sort of contemplate the end game, the end of our life. And here's number three. It's what we leave behind is what we weave in the hearts of other people.
Yeah.
So I always ask people, especially young people, to think about the end game. Mm-hmm. What are people going to say about you at your funeral? You know, what is your legacy going to be? Mm-hmm. And I know a lot of people don't think about this, especially today, but would your ancestors be proud of the life that you've lived? Mm-hmm. And I think it's important to think about that, especially when you're young, because if you don't like the answers to those questions, you have time to change them. You have time to make improvements in your life. And I know some people are like, yeah, I don't care what people think and stuff like that. And I get it. I'm not saying you need to live your life for somebody else. But, you know, at the end of your life, if people are like, man, he was a jerk, I'm not sure we, you know, any of us would want to kind of go to our grave thinking, man, people couldn't stand me.
Yeah.
So anyway, something to think about. That's number three. Number four is pretty self-evident. As long as you don't quit, as long as you don't give up, you can never be defeated. And, you know, the pain we all experience in life, the pain that I experience is going to end someday. May end through surgery. It may end through medication. It may end because I die. But if I quit, if I give up, I'm always going to have pain with me. That pain is always going to stay with me. So I always tell people, just keep going. I know it sucks, but sometimes that suck can be used to make you a stronger individual.
Yeah, absolutely. Wow. I mean, all of that, all the four truths are self-explanatory when you say it as you've said it, but only for people that are willing to keep their minds open to any sort of new changes or new ideas and new options. But for a lot of people, you know, the four truths can be really difficult. You know, where was your very first sort of light bulb moment when it came to the four truths? Was there a moment where you sort of thought, okay, this has to change?
You know, I think it sort of started back in high school when, you know, I kind of realized that my brain was putting all this negative garbage into my thoughts. And I was like, you know, no, if I listen to that, if that continues, then, you know, all I'm going to do is go down a path of negativity and bitterness. Mm-hmm. So I knew in high school, probably when I was 15 years old, that it's like, you need to change that narrative. You can't let your brain control you like that, because I mean, our brains like the status quo. You know, things are the way they are. Don't change them. You know, people that look for a new job are, you know, we all know people, you know, they should be working somewhere else, but for some reason they stay put. And I think it's because of their brains. Their brains are like, you know what? Hey, the work is easy here. You understand how things are. You're making good money. And hey, you go to another company, you may not get along with the employees there. All that stuff is designed to keep you right where you are. And the only way you're going to grow in life, the only way you're going to get better, is to do the things that make you uncomfortable. I always tell young people, especially, if you have a passion, if there's something in your heart that is like, I want to do this and I'm burning to do this, but it scares you, go ahead and do it. Yeah. Because at the end of your life, the things you're going to regret are not going to be the things you did. They're going to be the things that you didn't do. Yeah. So whatever that passion is for you. And, you know, when I graduated from college, my dad had my whole life planned out. You know, you're going to go to college, you're going to major in business, then you're going to go into business. You know, and I was like, no, Dad, that's what you want me to do.
Yes.
That's not what I was put on this earth to do.
Yeah.
But he was also dying of cancer at the time, so I didn't want to upset him. So I waited until he passed away, but I eventually went down my path, not his path.
And so that leads me on to, you've gone down your path now that you are happy and content with. And just talk a bit about that for us. What is your path that you've gone down?
So my path was really to be in law enforcement. My grandfather was a police officer in Chicago from 1924 to 1954. I didn't really know him. He died when I was like 6 or 7, but my grandmother, his wife, lived until I was in college. So I got to hear a lot of the stories. And, you know, my grandfather was shot actually with his own gun in the line of duty. And my dad remembered the stories my grandmother told about the knock on the door and, you know, Mrs. Tucker, grab your son, your husband's been shot, come with us. And he was like, absolutely not. I don't want that life for you. But that was the life that I was put here to do. I had a player one time who moved to the area where my wife and I live now. And we'd had dinner with them, and her and her boyfriend. And I said to her one day, I'm really excited that you're living so close because I can watch you find and live your purpose. And she kind of got quiet for a while, and she looked at me and she said, well, Coach, what do you think my purpose is? I said, I don't know what your purpose is. That's what your life should be about, finding the reason that God put you on the face of this earth and then live that purpose. And she kind of hit me with a question a little later. She was like, well, what if I run out of time? And I said, you know, I'm not God. I don't have any great connection. You know, I mean, he's not in my head or anything like that. But I can't believe that a God that created you to do something and put you here on this earth would not allow you the time to do it as long as you were continuing to search for it with an open heart. Mm-hmm. And if you do that, I think you'll have plenty of time to find that purpose and then to live it.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Trust the process, believe it. And, you know, and also as well, I feel that, you know, we're very much very similar in the sort of self-improvement and the positivity world that we've, you know, we've both come into. I mean, through, you know, there has been for me, from the reason why, one of the main reasons why I came down the road of this, the self-improvement side, is because I had things that I thought, I'm not quite that, that's not working anymore, but I still keep doing the same thing, but expecting a different outcome. And I knew then it was like my mind had to shift the mind pattern in me, because it's a like a habit, isn't it? It's a frequency that is just, it's setting us from a very young age. You know, like you said, when you were in your teenage years, it started to become more highlighted for you, didn't it? You know, and you were sort of starting to think, oh, hold on a minute, this isn't quite how things should be. So can I then ask then, because obviously now you've released your book, congratulations.
Thank you.
Congratulations. So with sustainable excellence, can you just now sort of, you know, explain the purpose and the reason behind your book?
It's the first book that I've ever published, you know, so I mean, I had to learn all about this kind of publishing game. But sure. The book was born out of two stories. And one is the one I already told you about, my former player. And the second one was an individual from college who had connected with me on LinkedIn. And he wanted to know what I thought were the most important things that he should learn to not only be successful in his job or in business, but to be successful in life. And I didn't want to give him the, you know, work hard, get up early, help. Not that those aren't important. They are incredibly important. But I kind of felt they'd been done. And I wanted to give him something different, something that maybe would go deeper, maybe into his soul, so to speak. So I spent some time and I wrote some thoughts, some notes and things like that. And eventually I came up with these 10 principles, these 10 ideas, and I sent them to him. I was feeling pretty good about it. And then I kind of stepped back and I was like, you know, I've got a life story that fits under this principle, or I know somebody whose life emulates this principle. So literally between the time I had my leg amputated in April of last year and the time I started the chemotherapy for the tumors in my lungs in June, I sat down at the computer and started to build stories underneath these principles. Mm-hmm. And that's pretty much how the book came about. And I always say that I wrote it. And again, you know, I talked about the three F's, faith, family, and friends. Mm-hmm. I really kind of feel the book was inspired for me by God, you know, for you, you know, your listeners, whatever that means for you. I don't want to put my religion on you, but it was inspired by something that was bigger than me, something well above, as I sort of joke, my pay grade and that. Yeah, yeah. So, you know, I had this thing and it was like, okay, now I got to do something with it. And when the book came out, I was like, I got to sell books. I got to sell books. I got to sell books. And I had a best-selling author in the UK who I'd connected with on LinkedIn kind of pulled me aside, so to speak, on the internet. And he said, Terry, you're totally missing the point here. Your job is to help people, not to sell books. If you help people, your books will sell themselves. And he was so right, because I wrote the book to help people, not to, you know, not to make a name for myself or to make money or anything like that. But yet I was all initially caught up and I've got to sell books. And he's like, no, do what you do and the books will sell themselves. So I was so glad that he kind of reached out and sort of slapped me in the face a little bit with that.
Yeah, sure. And that's great, isn't it? When you definitely get other people that just give you that in, like, just encouragement and lead you in the right direction. Because, I mean, I don't know about you, Terry, but for me, in our sort of the world that we present, you know, as the self-improvement, the positive, you know, all of the real mindfulness world that we're in, we're all about sort of, we're really sort of kind hearted spirits. And, you know, that's all you really want, them type of people like you to come into your life the same as you are. And especially if they reach out and they're just there full of advice and, you know, leading you in the right direction. It's just amazing. So, anything else about the book that you just want to delve in a little bit deeper with?
You know, I kind of, one of the chapters that I like a lot, and, you know, the principles are 1 through 10. They're not in any order. You know, one is not any better than 10 or anything like that. But the one I like, and it kind of goes back to what we were talking about earlier about controlling your mind, is that, and I've seen this and I've done it, and you probably have done it too, is one of the chapters is called "Most People Think with Their Fears and Their Insecurities Instead of Using Their Minds." Mm-hmm. And I know I've done that. I know, you know, I'd like to do that. Ooh, that scares me. No, I don't think I'm going to do that.
Of course.
That's my fear. You know, that's my fear ruling my life. That's not my mind saying, yeah, I think that's a good idea. Mm-hmm. You know? And so that, I mean, that's one chapter. There's a chapter about the importance of listening. And when I was a police officer, and this is probably, you know, it's like, oh yeah, why are you bringing this up? When I'm dealing with somebody, it's usually face to face. You know, I'm talking to them and I've been called to investigate or whatever it is. And if they're doing something, you know, if you were, you know, balling up your fists or, you know, you were kind of looking around or stuff like that, I might be able to see that and say, oh, she wants to fight me or she's thinking about running. And I could do something about it. I could sit you down. I could handcuff you. I could put you in the car, whatever was appropriate for what I was doing. But when we were negotiating, we weren't with the person. The person wasn't there with us. Mm-hmm. So we had to figure things out based on what people were saying, what they weren't saying, and how they were saying it. Mm-hmm. And I mean, think about it. You know, when we were doing crisis negotiation, if you were talking to me, you were probably having the worst day of your life. So I had to figure out where you were going. You know, I had to figure out what the problem was. And so I felt it was important to include a chapter about listening, not listening to respond, but listening to understand. You know, what's Nick saying? Why is she saying that? You know, that kind of a thing. And you see it. I'm sure you see it. I see it certainly here in America with we're just screaming at each other, you know, and you're screaming at me. I'm screaming. I don't understand what you're saying. You don't understand what I'm saying. I mean, we're not at a point where we're listening to understand. All we want to do is respond. You know, yeah, I think you're dumb or you're in the wrong party or whatever. You know, that's not productive at all. We're not getting anything out of that. If we would just step back and say, where is that person? What are they saying? And where are they coming from based on what they're saying? I think we can get a whole lot more done in this world.
So interesting, actually, because by you being the sort of the negotiator, I mean, that's a really, it's a life-threatening job, right? Because at the end of the day, it is life or death with, you know, especially when it comes to certain, well, I would imagine every time that you were to do that. And then it's interesting then that you also say that you need to be the psychologist, be mindset, because you're not physically seeing that person, obviously. So you're either listening to them through, you know, a radio or however the communication thing is. So all you're hearing is their voice. You know, obviously, like you said, they've had this is their worst day ever. So you know already that their mind is in a very dark area. So what's your tools, your techniques? I'm just really intrigued as to how you, I mean, you don't need to tell me any sort of story or any in-depth conversation towards that, but what's your trick? You know, what are the parts that you use to negotiate, to calm the situation down? And
so usually when we're negotiating, and I try to put this in kind of a simple concept. So we've probably all been to the park and been on a teeter totter. That's what we call it here in the United States. You know, you're kind of going back and forth. So
yeah.
So when we start talking to the person, their emotional side is way up in the air, and you can't make good decisions when you're only in an emotional state. Mm-mm. So what our technique was to use open-ended questions, you know? So what I hear you saying is, you know, your mom really pisses you off. Mm-hmm. And I say pisses off because you have to define the feeling. I mean, you can't just say, I mean, if the person's incredibly upset with their mother and you say, oh, you're mad. Oh, hell no, I'm not mad. I'm livid. Yeah. You have to define the emotion, and then you just throw it back at them and you let them talk. Mm-hmm. And over time, you burn off a lot of that emotion. So the teeter totter kind of comes to equilibrium. Mm-hmm. And then as you continue to talk and you continue to ask more questions, hopefully the rational side of them now is up in the air and the emotional side is way down on the ground. Now, when you're rational, you can make good decisions for yourself. And when you're rational, we can talk about you coming out or letting a hostage go or putting the gun down or whatever it was. So we have to get the person to that point. Mm-hmm. Now, there are times where I'd say 90% of the time we were successful in whatever the incident was, bringing it to a safe and peaceful conclusion. But there was probably 10% of the time where the person took their own life. They chose to do that. And I don't mean for this to sound callous or crass, but I never lost any sleep over that because one, I had great training. We worked with a psychologist. We went through all kinds of scenarios. And the thing you got to remember was when we did this, I may have been talking to the person, but I had another negotiator sitting right next to me listening and passing me notes. Mm-hmm. And then there were two or three more negotiators that were trying to collect intelligence, you know, talking to the person's mother or their wife or whatever it was. Mm-hmm. And you know, you'd get a note. Don't talk about their mother because they're mad at their mother. Okay, so I'm not going down that road. So it was not just, you know, me doing it. It was a group effort. So when somebody decided they were going to kill themselves, that was their decision. I knew I did the best I could with the best people and the best training. And it really wasn't fair to bring me into a situation that may have been evolving over, you know, 10, 20, 30, 40 years. And in 2, 3, 4, 5 hours, expect me to, you know, turn it around and make everybody, you know, sing kumbaya and we're all great. That just wasn't realistic, but we did it enough times and we're good at it that 90% of the time we got the person out without anybody getting hurt.
Amazing. Well, none of it's amazing in that respect, but it just feels I can't even imagine how it would feel, but for you, but especially when you know, that all ends with no life that's been taken, you know, right, at the end of that. So what are you doing now? What do you do with your days now, Terry? What's your days? What are you doing?
Podcasts, in all honesty. Yeah. I mean, I've probably done well over 100 by now. And, you know, when you're a motivational speaker in the middle of a COVID pandemic, there really aren't a lot of avenues to do that. So, you know, it's nice people like you that provide people like me with a forum that hopefully between the two of us having this conversation, we're going to make a difference in somebody's life. Yeah. And I don't know how much more time I have left, probably not a lot, So I want to spend it, you know, putting as much goodness, love, and positivity back into the world.
Yeah.
And, you know, people talk to me about dying. Dying doesn't scare me. It, you know, I found my purpose. I found the reason God put me here. I live that purpose. So I kind of look at it like, okay, I did what I was supposed to do.
I'm like that, Terry. I'm not scared of dying. I'm not at all. Actually, to be honest with you, all I know is I've definitely got more to do before I die. And I've crossed my fingers as I say that, because never take life for granted.
Right.
I do treat each day as not my last, but I make sure that every day is the best that I can make it, because you never know what's around the corner, right? So I'm very much about, I'm like you, to leave a legacy for when I die as well, because a bit like what you touched on earlier, you know, when people are at your funeral, it would be great to be talking great stuff about you instead of nothing, sort of thing. So I'm on your wavelength with that, definitely. So what other things? I mean, this is, we've got at least another 10 minutes of talking. So
sure.
If there's any other sort of subjects you want to touch on, or something that you want to add to, you just, carry on.
So, you know, I wrote the book, and it's a book about, I guess, for lack of a better word, success. You know, how do you be successful? Maybe, you know, you're a successful podcaster. Maybe I'm a successful author. And when I released it, you know, I started thinking about, was that the right thing? And I think it was, don't get me wrong, but I guess I was kind of like, is there more? Is there something else out there that maybe I missed? And I think I did. And I think I'm kind of compiling, haven't started writing yet, a second book that I want to focus on another S word. Instead of success, I want to focus on significance, because success is what we do. Mm-hmm. We are successful. And I think significance is more what we do for other people. Now, don't get me wrong. I think you can be both. I think you can be successful and significant, but I think significance is definitely something that in the second book, I would like to spend more time on that and less time on how you as an individual become successful.
Interesting.
If that makes any sense.
Of course it does. Interesting. Have you got any ideas yet, or did you want to share some with us, or not yet? No.
Not yet. I'm kind of pulling stories together and things like that. And
we thought we might got a little bit of insider there before.
My mind isn't that organized yet. Sure. You know, I haven't quite figured out how I want to lay it out, set it up and things like that. But, you know, it's definitely something that I think the next book I would like to focus on. And I guess maybe going back to kind of what we were talking about, you know, in terms of living your purpose, there was an author here in the United States by the name of Mark Twain, who long passed on. But he had a great saying, and he said, you know, the two most important days of our lives are the day that we're born and the day we figure out why. And I love that quote, because, you know, so many people spend their time not figuring that out, they kind of live a casual life. And as a result of living a casual life, their dreams, their goals, their ambitions become a casualty of sort of that unplanned living. And there's a Native American Blackfoot, which a Native American group of people here in the United States, that had a great saying that I heard a while ago. And it was like, when you were born, you cried and the world rejoiced. Live your life in such a way so that when you die, the world cries and you rejoice. And
love,
I think
that.
I love it too.
I love that.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just, you know, let, you know, it kind of goes back to the end game, like what we were talking about earlier.
Sure.
and that, and I love that. And I think that's great. And I'll leave you with one final story. So when I was a young kid, I was a big fan of kind of cowboys and Indians. And my parents used to let me stay up late to, you know, watch different shows. Well, and you may have seen this movie. In 1993, the movie Tombstone came out.
Yeah.
Big movie around the world. And it starred Val Kilmer as a person by the name of John Doc Holliday and Kurt Russell as a man by the name of Wyatt Earp. Now, Wyatt Earp and Doc Holliday were two living, breathing human beings that actually walked on the face of the earth. They're not made up characters just for the movie. Mm-hmm. So in this particular scene, Doc was dying at a sanitarium at a hospital in Glenwood Springs, Colorado, which is about 3 hours from my house. And he was called Doc because he was a dentist by trade. But in all honesty, he was pretty much a card shark and a gunslinger is really what he was. And Wyatt had been a lawman his entire life, been, you know, a sheriff and a deputy and all that. And at this point in his life, he's destitute. He has no money, has no job, he has no prospects for a job. So every day he comes to play cards with Doc, and the two men pass the time by playing cards. And in this scene, they're talking about what they want out of life. And Doc says, I was in love with my cousin when I was young, but she joined a convent over the affair. Uh-huh. But she's all I ever wanted. And he looks at Wyatt and he says, what about you, Wyatt? What do you want? And Wyatt says, kind of nonchalantly, I just want to lead a normal life. And Doc looks at him and says, there's no normal, there's just life. And get on with living yours. You know, we're all kind of waiting for that, you know, well, if this happens, then yeah. I'll do this. Yeah. Or if that happens, then I'll, you know, go down this road. Don't wait. Because there is no, you know, I just want to live. There's no normal. There's no great. There's no nothing. There's just life. Get out there and live your life.
Wow, that, you're definitely brilliant. Absolutely. Honestly, you are truly, truly an amazing gentleman, I'd like to call you.
Thank you.
Because in England, that's what we call men, is gentlemen. And you so are definitely one of them. And I just want, because I know the listeners as well, they will be absolutely captivated by this episode of your just being so open and honest as well, which is, I want to thank you also for that. And also thank you for your time, you know, because I know everybody's all, you know, got their lives going on, everything else, but it's just amazing to be able to bring on to my show people that I really sort of connect with on a soul level. And that's really important for me and for my listeners. And I would just absolutely, if you wouldn't mind, love bringing you back on in a future season or an episode, because I feel you've got so much more. There's so much that you can offer to the listeners. But just before we go, I would love it if you could just let the listeners know where they can get in touch with you if they want to reach out to you. Where's your book? Where can they buy it from? You know, all the details. Just fire away, Terry.
Sure. So I'll start with the book. The book is called Sustainable Excellence, The 10 Principles of Living Your Uncommon and Extraordinary Life. You can get that on Amazon, barnesandnoble.com, Apple iBooks, pretty much anywhere online you can get a book, you can find Sustainable Excellence. In terms of getting in touch with me, I have a website called Motivational Check, and motivationalcheck.com will get you to me. Every day I put a new kind of thought for the day up on that. I put on the Monday morning motivational message, which is usually a story or a video. But I realize people are busy, so everything on there is short. You want to go get a quick hit of inspiration or motivation, go there, then get on with your day. So motivationalcheck.com will get you there. It'll get you to my social media sites. And then if you want to send me an email, motivationalcheck@AOL.com, you can do that.
Absolutely brilliant. Thank you so much, Terry, for your time. And if you want to say goodbye to the listeners.
Yes. Thank you, everybody, for listening. I know you have other things to do. And I know Nick and I myself certainly appreciate you listening.
Absolutely. And thanks everyone for today. We will I'll be back very soon on the podcast show, because I've got a few little things that are going to be happening with the business side of it. So for now, my lovely listeners, love and light until next time.